The Spectator is looking for the UK's brightest entrepreneurs for our Economic Innovator of the Year Awards, sponsored by private bank Julius Baer. If you run a business that brings radical positive change and is capable of achieving national or international impact, we want to hear from you. Apply by 1st of July at spectator.co.uk/innovator.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Fraser Nelson and James Forsyth. James, we just had Prime Minister's questions and it's been tricky in recent weeks for Boris Johnson, though last week he did appear to get the upper hand to a degree. Today, Keir Starmer went on Test and Trace. How did that go for the Prime Minister?
So it's a real clash of styles, PMQs now. Keir Starmer comes with a series of detailed questions, and Boris Johnson just hits him with a kind of wall of words, changes the subject almost at random. And look, it's not particularly edifying, but so far it has been quite effective, I think, for Boris Johnson in stymieing Keir Starmer's attacks. As one lobby colleague put it to me, you know, he's just kind of collapsing the scrum. And that does make it hard for Keir Starmer to make progress. You know, I thought you saw a sign of how Keir Starmer will try and combat this in his final question, which was to Boris Johnson. You said this last week about child poverty. The Children's Commissioner says your answer is mostly false. You know, you give dodgy answers. But I think the problem for Keir Starmer is that moment a week late doesn't have anywhere near the same political impact it does in the heat of the moment. And I think one of the challenges for Keir Starmer is that he, as you've written, he's a naturally kind of risk-averse, cautious politician. And I think he hasn't quite worked out how to counter this just barrage of words that comes out of Boris Johnson's mouth. And there's something almost kind of physical about the way Boris Johnson kind of they talk about how pubs are not going to be able to play music, so they don't want people to kind of talk at a loud volume. I think Boris Johnson is definitely in breach of that social distancing rule in the House of Commons. He's kind of leans across the dispatch box and tries to make himself look as physically big as possible, all 17 and a half stone of him, and kind of just flies words out to almost try and push Keir Starmer back.
Fraser, we've heard this week the reports that Dominic Cummings told special advisers Keir Starmer was a Remainer lawyer. We also saw today at Prime Minister's Questions Keir Starmer almost embracing the fact that he is a lawyer, someone who's trained in the legal profession. He was saying, you know, there's your witness. He was using these terms almost as though he was in a courtroom. Do you think this helps the Labour leader? Or do you think some in the Tory party are right to say that actually it helps, if anything, the government that he embraces that role?
I think it makes sense for him to try various formats of attack, and he'll find one that works in Boris. Right now, almost every single PMQ, as we can see this, he'll find a slightly different way of attacking the Prime Minister, find a slightly different way of defending. And this week he was using the language saying, here is the evidence, I'm a lawyer, I rest my case. In other words, he might as well own it. He is Sir Keir Starmer, a former DPP, he's not exactly Bob from the oil rig. So he's going to try to just make the most of his credentials as one of the most successful lawyers in the country in recent memory. This is not a thing to be embarrassed about. And David Cameron came to turn his negatives into positives. I mean, Sir Keir would be able to do it as well. And I think if the Tories basically say, look at these lawyers, everybody hates a lawyer, I'm not sure that particularly works. I don't think people do really hate lawyers. And also, Keir Starmer is a relatively good lawyer. My hunch is he will ultimately win. He will find a line, a way in to get under Boris's skin. And I think his aim is not so much to get an answer, but to expose what he regards as Boris's weak spots, his lack of attention to detail, his decision to grasp onto an answer, whether it's technically true or not. You can see ways in which I think his build-up is going to try to be, his technique is going to be to try to expose, or rather impugn, the Prime Minister as being a bumbling idiot. And that's the most effective attack line, so you could see it now. I actually thought that the better question came from the Labour backbenches, where Boris Johnson was asked about discharging all of these pensioners from hospitals to the care homes, he was saying, oh, that was done in a medical decision. Now, we all know that's not quite the case. It is true the doctors signed off, but they also had instructions, which were agreed from the top, to get as many people out of hospitals as they could in preparation for what everybody thought at the time would be the inundation of intensive care units. It turns out that the evasive action taken then was to sow the seeds for the death toll we're seeing now by sending so many people into care homes. So right now, I think the government's defence, it wasn't us, it was these doctors, will not stand up to much scrutiny. And it's interesting to see, actually, the Labour backbenches get on the scent that the Labour leader wasn't quite able to get onto, because I think that trail will lead to a place that will deeply embarrass the Conservatives.
Now, James, on Test and Trace, we heard yesterday in the Prime Minister's last press conference for a while that Test and Trace is crucial to the UK being able to relax social distancing and keep it that way, hopefully. Boris Johnson suggested that this would be okay because we have a great test and trace system. But if we look at the details of Test and Trace, there's still a lot left to be desired. There isn't an app. The Prime Minister won't want to say no country has an app that's working to the degree the UK government wants it to. But is it currently in a fighting fit shape where without improvements it can take us to the winter, or does much more need to be done?
I think that frankly there are now two options for the government, given that the app is, you know, the app is in development. And I think one thing we have learned during this pandemic is relying on a technological solution that is in development, it is not a particularly sensible basis for policy. So I think the government has two choices. One is to go down the route being advocated by Tony Blair, William Hague, Jeremy Hunt, and basically go for mass testing to test particularly people who come into lots of members of the public. So hospital staff and care home staff in particular, as Matt Ridley has written, if it seems to be a particularly virulent disease in those settings. And so if you can isolate out people with the disease and almost separate those places from the community, you know, create essentially modern day fever hospitals, then I think that would help slow the spread of the disease. That's option one. And option two is the Singapore solution, which is that rather than an app, you give everyone a kind of almost like a bracelet with Bluetooth embedded in it, and that enables you to say who you've been in contact with. Now, some people say, oh, wouldn't work. When I put this to someone in government earlier, they said, oh, it wouldn't work. People here would be reluctant to basically be tagged almost like a prisoner on release. But I don't see how that Singaporean solution is more invasive than the app. And given that you can't make the app work in terms of, I mean, the particular concern in government is the distancing point, that Fraser and I are currently sitting 2 metres apart. We won't yet move to 1 metre plus until July 4th. But but the worry is that the app might say that I have been within 2 metres of him, forcing me to self-isolate for 14 days if Fraser developed coronavirus. And I mean, that's one of the worries, is that this, even the Google Apple app is struggling to calibrate distance as precisely as you would like.
It's also quite interesting to see what's happening in America now. You're getting states like Arizona that are late to this COVID crisis. They are now experiencing what other states experienced in April. And they're not locking down, not again. I mean, they locked down when they didn't have a crisis. Now they do have one. But they're working out now with their more modern tools at disposal than a crude lockdown, which causes so much economic and social damage. And we're seeing now sort of local quarantines. We're seeing that in Germany and other places. And they're working out, for example, that if you're young, it's not that much of a problem. You've got a 99.9% chance of recovery if you're under 70. They're working out that as long as the hospital units are not inundated, as long as they're not overwhelmed, then normal life can carry on as normal. So by the time we actually get the technology ready, I actually think that countries, whether it's American states or Germany, where they had a local outbreak in a meat processing factory, or in Korea, where they had some school outbreak and did local quarantines, they will have worked out that there's a better way of doing this. And there's also some research from Italy recently showing that something like 80% of COVID patients did not have any symptoms. Now, if 4 out of 5 people don't even know they've got the virus, how on earth is track and trace supposed to work? It will be spread very quickly by people who just don't experience symptoms, who are never going to register. I just still cannot see how the best track and trace system in the world can stop a largely asymptomatic virus.
Now, finally, there's another story that seems to be in the papers nearly every day, and that relates to Robert Jenrick, the housing secretary. James, this all goes back to a decision by Jenrick to greenlight a housing development by Richard Desmond that was later found to be unlawful. And there are more questions being asked, both by Labour, but also stories in the press about whether there was lobbying, his involvement. Now, we don't know the specifics. Documents are supposed to be brought forward. But just on a political level, how likely is it, do you think, that he's going to stay in position in the sense that are number 10 very keen to keep him in place? Because it's one of those stories that does not really seem to be going away.
So I think number 10 would be very reluctant to lose him for several reasons. First of all, Robert Jenrick was one of those three ministers, you know, up-and-coming ministers who backed Boris Johnson. And in Johnson folklore, during the Tory leadership contest, in Johnson folklore, this endorsement was the moment the tide turned and the path to victory opened
up. So it was Rishi Sunak, Oliver Dowden,
and Rob Jenrick. So I think that's reason one. Secondly, I think he's regarded as one of the more competent ministers. And I think in number 10, they have a view that they're not overly overstocked with competent ministers. And then I think the third thing is there is a distinct argument that Robert Jenrick was put in this position by other people. So he turns up to his Tory fundraising dinner and finds that Richard Desmond, who has this property development at West Ferry Printworks that you're talking about, is sitting on his table. And Richard Desmond then shows Robert Jenrick a video of, you know, a couple of minutes of the promotional video for the development. Now, I think you can definitely say that whoever was doing the table plan was at best guilty of a kind of inattention to detail to put to put a cabinet minister who was going to take that decision in place. I mean, you know, the press are there are more stories today about how Tory councillors overruled the planning officers to approve a development at Jenrick's own Westminster house. But I think this then takes you to the final reason why I think number 10 will be reluctant to lose him. The big supply-side reform idea, you know, the one that Dominic Cummings was talking about in the SPAD meeting you wrote about yesterday, is about reform of the planning system. And these are ideas that they have developed in conjunction with Robert Jenrick. And so I think the danger for the government is that this whole case gets caught up with their desire to change the planning system. But there's all equally a danger that you try and move him or bring someone else in and you have to kind of go back to square one in terms of bringing the Secretary of State along board with these changes that you want to make to the planning system. And so I think for all of those reasons, and I would also add another reason, it doesn't harm number 10's relationship with ministers to show that number 10 is prepared to go out and defend ministers as well as advisers when they're in trouble.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Fraser. And thank you for listening.
The Spectator is looking for the UK's brightest entrepreneurs for our Economic Innovator of the Year Awards, sponsored by private bank Julius Baer. If you run a business that brings radical positive change and is capable of achieving national or international impact, we want to hear from you. Apply by 1st of July at spectator.co.uk/innovator.